You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome, fellow time travelers, to another episode of Silver Screen Podcast. We need your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle. Not really. We are simply here to dissect the greatest hits of cinematic history with the precision of a T-800. Today, we're rewinding our reels to a time when Schwarzenegger was the ultimate action hero and liquid metal was more than just a kitchen utensil. That's right, folks. Buckle up your cybernetic exoskeletons as we dive deep into the iconic sci-fi masterpiece, Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Get ready for a review so electrifying even Skynet would be impressed. But I am your regular host, of course, Mike Wilson. But I'm not on my own. I'm joined by my my counterpart, the T-1000 to my T-800, perhaps the Kyle Reese, I don't know. DK, welcome.
Well, thank you. That's a nice bike you've got there.
You forgot to say please. So, yeah, it's just going to be the two of us, the two sort of podcast guys for this one. We did have a third guest planned, but
he's been terminated.
Because we've been very, very thoroughly let down. So I'm containing the rage as best I can with my best stoic T-800, and we're just going to get on with it, just myself and DK, as I said. It's been a while since we've had an episode, just the two of us, but hopefully it won't be too disappointing for all of y'all, and it means we can get through some things about this movie. I think we were probably going to start. Well, I'm basically going to explain, first of all, that the version that we're fully officially reviewing of this movie is the theatrical version, because DK decided that, you know, it would be the version most people would have seen and be most familiar with. I will say it's not my preferred version. My preferred version would be the special edition, the first one, not the, because there's been like two. But I will go over all the differences and the various scenes and stuff later on in the review once we've talked about the film itself. So, you know, fear not. I've got a pretty thorough breakdown, if anybody wants it, for all of those scenes are that you're missing. And yeah, there's some good ones. But yeah, so before we jump fully into the behind the scenes, which DK is going to handle, I was going to do what we always do and just ask if you can remember, DK, your first time experience of viewing this film and what you thought at the time.
I do believe I actually did see this at the cinema. I mean, it was...
Wow.
You were going to kind of be a sucker not to at that point. It was just everywhere.
I didn't.
Did you not?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh, God. That surprised me. Yeah.
I was only nine.
Dude, that doesn't stop us in England. Yeah, I do remember going to see it, and I remember... loving it. I remember loving it to the point where I can't remember much about the cinema experience itself. I just remember really liking it. And then my parents, who knew I was into collecting soundtracks at the time, they went away and they picked me up the soundtrack for this on cassette. And okay, it lasted two plays and then crinkled up. So, Saraband, Your tape quality stock was absolute shite, mate.
There's a huge section of our audience that are just so confused by what you're saying because they have no idea what a tape is or how it crinkles or that little... They've never had to suffer the indignity of winding the little internal reel with a pencil to try and tighten the tape.
So I went immediately outside, cranked up my engine on the car, you know, and yeah. Took it back to the general store.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a very good soundtrack, both the score and the actual music choices, for the most part, I would say as well. So, yeah, my first time viewing this was actually at a kind of house party, weirdly enough, and it wasn't even mine. It was my sister was having a house party with friends of hers over at their house, and they were all a lot older, so they were watching, you know, what the Americans would call R-rated movies, and we call like 15, I guess. So they basically were like, well, you can sit with us if you want, because they were all of the like lads, but we're watching like 15 rated movies. And I think they may have decided to have picked the one that was tamest, because as I said, I was like probably 10 years old at that point. It had just come out on video back then, again, age. Ooh. So yeah, I sat down with them to watch this and was just absolutely mesmerized and blown away and was just like, wow, I can't believe films can do this. And yeah, I did see this before seeing the first Terminator, bizarrely. Oh, wow. I've obviously seen both now. So yeah, Terminator 2, I definitely saw first. And that first experience, obviously I was super young and I didn't really know enough to follow the story as such. So my first experiences with it were really just being wowed by the special effects, the funny lines and the direction and the way it works. And I've long said, you know, James Cameron's one of my favorite directors, Avatar notwithstanding. as you'll know if you heard our review of the first one, which would still fare better than any review we'd ever do of the second one, which probably won't happen. But yeah, anyway.
Weirdly enough, I saw the first one when it was released on video. And I think I was only around, I was very young at the time. And I loved it, so I was buzzing for this one.
Kind of semi-related to that, my next question was going to be, this film, surprisingly, like we've mentioned, kind of, or alluded to, is from 1991. So do you think it holds up, TK, and how well, maybe?
Honest to God? I think this... I'm jumping ahead here, but I honestly think it could have... With a couple of minor exceptions, to me, this could have been filmed last year.
Yeah, 34 years old, just to clarify that.
I slag him off. I consider him a hack sometimes, and, you know, I've made my feelings quite well known on this show. But hats off, credit where it's due. This film is a blinder for Cameron.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it changed the game for special effects in some pretty huge ways. Yeah. Based on, you know, he did the foundational work with The Abyss for a couple of scenes, obviously, with the... like fluid, water, alien things, but this was just like, I mean, we'll get to it eventually, I'm sure, but, you know, the first fully CGI character, you know, if it hadn't have worked, it would have completely screwed the film over, but
yeah.
And again, if you're, we say this all the time, but if you're playing the drinking game at home, yes, I did watch Terminator 2 on 4K, which was another reason why I watched the theatrical version, because disgustingly, it is the only version that's on the 4K disc, which I was kind of annoyed about, because like I said, it's not my preferred version, and the Blu-ray that comes with it still has all of the different versions, because there's the, you know, the special edition and the ultimate edition, whatever else. If you are in the market for the 4K, it's kind of a mixed bag, because I will say that, although I don't always say this, sometimes the restorations look a bit kind of like, oh, can you tell the difference? It is one of the best actual 4K, you know, restorations that I've seen, up there with like the Star Trek film, sorry, and such. And it looks incredible, but like I said, it's baffling to me that they haven't included anything other than the theatrical version. Although a tiny bit of research did reveal that it's because they did all the cleanup and the 4K remaster to release it in 3D in the cinema. So it is just the same thing that they used for the 3D release, but not in 3D, because it actually comes up and says 3D movie at the start of the film, and it's not. So, incidentally, did you ever see the 3D version when it was back in cinemas?
I didn't. I didn't realize it was a thing.
Yeah, they were expecting it to be huge, and I think it just bombed terribly, because it was way after 3D was, you know, a thing that people were really bothering with.
Yeah.
And it was obviously a re-release of a movie that everybody had seen, but it was off the back of, obviously, Cameron had all that success with Avatar and stuff. So, Yeah, I mean, he did say that his preferred version of the film is the theatrical version, which is why he made it into 3D. And he tried to say at the time, this is the version that I want to everyone to think of when they think of Terminator 2 now is the 3D version. And in the end, nobody even cared. So yeah, bit of a misfire, I think, for Cameron. So he went off, cried, and wrote another 7 Avatar sequels. I'm sure. So the very last question I have before we get to your BTS and stop annoying the audience with these questions. How do you think this compares to the original Terminator, which we reviewed just last year?
I'm a big fan of the original. But this is one of the rare instances where, to me, the sequel is the better one out of the two.
Yeah, yeah. And I would agree. I think it's next level. I mean, when we reviewed The Terminator, we said, you know, we love it. There's a lot of good things about it. But where it falls apart is a couple of moments during the special effects. You know, the Stan Winston puppet when he's carving the eye out or whatever.
Yeah.
Not very convincing in that first Terminator. And the very jerky stop motion movements of the endoskeleton at the end of the movie are a little bit, you know, Scotch videotape advert from the 80s. That's a reference very few people will get, very niche. But yeah. I should have said something like it's like the Jason and the Argonaut skeletons or whatever, but yeah. So I think this the fact that this special effects on this, as you said, for being almost 35 years old, are flawless completely. You know, it's just unbelievable how well it holds up and how good it looks. Like I said, not just because it's had the 4K restoration, but it looks incredible. And as you said, in a lot of ways, with the exception of like maybe fashion and hairstyles and stuff, it could have been filmed yesterday or, yeah, you know, a couple of years ago. So
there are a couple of effect shots that do remind me of Lawnmower Man. They're still good. They still hold up. You know, they may not be cutting edge anymore, but my goodness, I wasn't expecting it to be as well done as it still is, if you know what I mean. There is a tendency to look back and think, oh my God, look at the effects on that. And when you look back at certain films, and I'm thinking specifically around the same era, things like Alien 3, when you see some of the composite shots on that, it doesn't hold up that great. But when you look at this, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful film to look at.
And I mean, it goes without saying that without the film, we wouldn't have had things like Jurassic Park, which they realized were only possible, you know, because of the CGI that worked so well in this, so that 2 years later, we got that movie with the fully CG dinosaurs. And that was another kind of leap forward in special effects. And, you know, that in turn led to things down the line like The Matrix and stuff. So I don't think it can be underestimated, the impact that it had. And the fact that, like I said, you can watch it now, and for me, at least, it loses none of its sheen. I don't think you watch it and think, oh, that bit's dated.
See, this is the thing. It did open the floodgates to a lot of good effects shots and effects-laden movies. Unfortunately, it also opened the door to a lot of movies which just kind of relied on special effects and not much else. And I think this is one of the ones that stand out simply because it's all round, it's just well done. It doesn't rely on just the effects to sell it.
And I think it's certainly not the only thing. Yeah, I mean, the story itself is fantastic, as we'll get into, and
yeah,
I think the acting and everything, it all combines to a brilliant thing. But I think, like I said, I just wanted to sort of to make it known that I think, like I said, the special effects are leaps and bounds above the first movie, which was already, you know, in its own way groundbreaking.
Yeah. I think what's disappointed me watching this recently is when you look back at films such as this, such as Jurassic Park, such as The Matrix, you know, even things like the first couple of Pirates of the Caribbean, whether you love the movies or not, the amount of talent and artistry that went into the special effects on those, and you look at the CG on those, and they still, to some extent, hold up. Unfortunately, we're in a situation now with the movie industry where everything is kind of like it's treated as a conveyor belt. So whereas before you had advances in special effects, if anything, the CG these days doesn't seem to hold up as well. And if you take something like, and you'll know this yourself, like last year's The Flash, the CG in that, and you compare it to this, there's just no comparison.
Yeah. But having said that, I mean, one of the things that The Flash is guilty of, and again, I'm probably, you know, touching on something you'll mention or we're going to mention in the BTS, but one of the things this film does do is to cleverly use things that are not special effects when it needs to. Yeah. So it creates a CGI character with the T-1000, but like it cleverly uses twins on a couple of occasions.
Yeah.
And which is such a lo-fi special effect. It's just like instead of CGIing an identical character, just use, so it's like the security guard that the T-1000 imitates is just, they're played by twins, so there's two of them.
Yeah.
And obviously when there's two Sarah Connors, it's Linda Hamilton's twin sister.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
But it's the editing in this, I mean, before we get to it, the editing helps immensely.
Oh yeah.
With that,
and like I said, I mean, as much as we say the CGI and everything was groundbreaking, like I said, the non-CGI stuff, the stunts, the viaduct sort of chase with the truck that's getting gradually smashed to bits, and the bike, and yeah, I mean, all of it, it all comes together brilliantly, right down to, you know, Schwarzenegger apparently repeatedly whacking Edward Furlong on the head with a shotgun as he was trying to learn how to twirl reload. Poor guy.
Let's be honest though, that does look freaking cool.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
It does look amazing. Yeah. Could be wrong. Without any more chatter then, and without, you know, saying anything else that I might be stepping on your toes, I'm going to move over to you properly for the behind the scenes section, which is always your purview, GK. So yeah, take it away. What do you have behind the scenes on Terminator 2?
Cool. Well, yeah, I mean, this is a tricky one. There's just so much behind the scenes stuff in this that if we were to go, you know, go through it all, we'd have an entire show just for that. So I've tried to keep it relatively short / interesting. I'll sprinkle a bit as we go, but I'll start off with this. The entire movie was shot in 8 months compared to the first film's 6-week schedule. It was on such a tight deadline as it had to be ready for the summer of 91 to meet its financial commitments. When James Cameron got the call from Carolco Pictures that the film was officially greenlit, one of the first things he said to his friend and co-writer William Wisher was, "The good news is we're making the sequel. The bad news is we're already several months behind schedule." Now, they used every available hour to write the initial draft because Cameron wanted to have a finished screenplay before the Cannes Film Festival, where Carolco would officially announce it. He did an all-nighter the night before the festival, printed the script out, so while a limousine was waiting to get him to the airport, it delayed the plane to Cannes, pissing the people off inside it, which was the Carolco delegation, which included Paul Verhoeven, Oliver Stone and Schwarzenegger. After boarding, Cameron just handed the script to Schwarzenegger and the producer Mario Casar, and then just went to sleep for the duration of the flight. Carolco executives were quite obviously nervous when the original budget of $75 million ballooned up to $88 million, with yet more to come later. In order to keep the budget manageable, they proposed to eliminate a few scenes, particularly, and this is just... this is executive thinking to me. The opening biker bar scene where he's introduced. They tried to get Schwarzenegger to persuade Cameron to remove that scene, but Schwarzenegger told them where to go, saying, "Only a studio guy would cut out a scene like that."
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. But despite all this, they easily made back their money. I mean, foreign distributors eagerly signed up for this film, even though it had more than 10 times the budget of the original, making it the most expensive film at the time in history. Obviously, this was something that Cameron is no stranger to, because he went on to do it in his following films, True Lies, Titanic and Avatar. But when the project was first announced in late 1984, the projected budget was $12 million. The final budget, when all was said and done, was $94 million. Despite initial studio concerns that the movie might be unable to recoup its costs, due to the lucrative distribution deals, the film had already earned back its budget before it played on a single screen. It was the first film to break $300 million at the international box office, outperforming the first movie's gross in just 4 days of it being open. In fact, with the film's domestic box office adjusted for inflation, it is still the top-grossing R-rated action film of all time. It's also the only Terminator film to win or be nominated for an Oscar. It won 4 out of the 6 it was nominated for. Now, a little something that is probably going to piss you off, Mike, especially with what's been going on. But on the DVD, by highlighting sensory control, then pressing the right navigation button 5 times, the words, "The future is not set," would appear. After selecting that phrase, the menu would alter, offering the viewer the option to view the special edition rather than the theatrical.
Yeah, I do know that.
I thought, I'll give that a go. It can't hurt, Mike. Do it on your
phone. No, I've done that. I've got the version. The version that I've got was the ultimate Blu-ray release, so it's like, it's got, you can choose original, special edition, or what they call ultimate edition, or like branch various scenes between them and stuff. So I've watched this film in about 20 different ways over the years. So I'm very familiar with what they cut and what they haven't, and the difference is even... The main difference from the special and the ultimate edition is just the ending, which is pretty terrible. The alternate ending's interesting, but I'm kind of glad. That's why I don't go with the ultimate edition, because I prefer the ending that we got to the other one. But again, I'll talk about that later, because I don't want to bog everyone down with all of that right now, so I'll talk about that after we've talked about the movie. So I say I have a detailed breakdown of what's in each version.
That's fine. Well, go for it then, mate. That's the BTS stuff to start off with.
Cool. Yeah, that's fair enough. Well, so what we're going to do then, we're going to break the review down the way we always do, because I've just got my notes in sections, as you'll know if you're a regular listener, and that is like writing and plot, then direction, then acting, then sort of production design, special effects, music and sound, visual effects, and anything else. And again, we don't stick rigidly to that. It's just for the purposes of our notes to sort of kick us off. If the conversation goes in one way, we'll follow it, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure you all know the spiel by now if you're regular listeners, and there's enough of you. So, yeah, the first thing that I wanted to jump in and talk about then is the writing, the overall plot of this, because as I kind of mentioned up top, I think it's kind of fascinating. It's quite a dense and complicated sci-fi plot for what you might initially perceive as a bit of a brainless action movie. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously it's a continuation of that first movie, so we kind of have to learn where Sarah is now, and we meet John Connor, who hadn't been born yet. And yeah, I mean, there's the plot of protecting John, but also as a huge part of the movie, the plot of trying to prevent Judgment Day. So it kind of has those two things going on, which obviously are, you know, inextricably linked in the movie. But again, it's kind of fascinating. And yeah, I do want to get into asking you about those. But first, the first thing I wanted to mention, because it's always been a bugbear of mine, is that this is one of the first examples where marketing basically ruined one of the big surprises and the big moment in the film, because they came out basically from the start and marketed that this time Arnie's the good guy. Can you believe it? And every time I watch the film, I'm like, this clearly wasn't designed for you to know that going in, because the opening scenes of the film are clearly that you're supposed to think, oh, it's another of the T-800s, like the first movie, and the Robert Patrick character is the equivalent of Kyle Reese.
Yeah.
And so you kind of lose like the impact of that twist reveal when, you know, the Terminator says, get down, and he starts shooting and the liquid metal appears. You see, I would have so much more impact if you hadn't.
It did
known
to me, because I had no idea. I didn't. The only
really?
Yeah, the only trailer, the only marketing thing that I'd seen up until seeing the movie itself was the old trailer that Stan Winston put together, which was
the production
conveyor
line,
belt.
Yeah.
So yeah, it does, you know, obviously play with your expectations. So I was wrong footed.
So I
can't remember any of that marketing, to be honest.
I know it's out there, because I mean, obviously it was lost on me anyway, because like I said, when I saw the film, I was new to everything, and so I had no idea. I wouldn't have had the baggage of the first movie coming in anyway. So I just kind of knew, oh, Arnie's the hero, and I wasn't expecting that. But like I said, when you watch it back, it's clear to me that Cameron is directing that as if that's supposed to be a shock reveal. And I was just curious if anybody had that moment, which you now said you did.
I was.
There was.
Yeah, I mean, I was completely wrong-footed by it because, and I, obviously, I've watched it so many times over the years that I've lost count. So going back this time, I was watching it from a perspective of trying to put myself back in those shoes. As if to say, you know, first time watching this, would I pick up on this? And it, and you do get the hint because Robert Patrick plays the T-1000 at that point early on in the film as, you know, quite a friendly friendly sort of character when he goes to visit John Connor's foster parents and he's like, oh, he's a good-looking boy and, you know, I just want to ask him a few questions and he's all smiles and stuff for the parents. Yeah.
And even when they mention, oh, there was another guy and he's like, no, don't worry about him and you're kind of like, oh, okay, so he was the baddie.
I mean, I found out that while looking at this, that Michael Biehn was actually the first choice for the role of the T-1000. So they wanted to play in a complete, you know, reversal of roles. But it ended up getting abandoned as they thought it might be just, you know, too confusing for viewers.
Yeah.
But even now, you know, you can watch it and I do still think it plays with your expectations. Again, as you said, marketing's utterly freaking ruined that for certain people, and it's now obviously got this reputation, the same way with it, you know, the reveal in Empire Strikes Back's got a reputation. People go into it with, you know, knowing full well what's going to happen. But at the time, I remember being just completely awestruck. I mean, you know, I was practically Linda Hamilton pushing herself back on the floor of the mental institution. Yeah. But when he comes round and he's, you know, and he shakes the gun free from that box of roses, at that point, it was a heart in throat moment.
Yeah, great use of slow motion as well by Cameron. As I say, as somebody who's watched a few too many Zack Snyder's overuse of slow motion, I think I saw a quote somewhere from James Cameron, which he said something like, slow motion is not for action sequences, it's for moments of dramatic tension. And I was like, wow, James Cameron, can you just sit down with Zack Snyder and just grab a cup of tea or something and be like, listen, buddy.
just have a good afternoon of negative reinforcement and maybe we'll get some good films out of this.
Yeah. He's done some good stuff. But yeah, certainly, like I said, you can see the overuse of slow-mo by a lot of directors, actually. But yeah, with Cameron, he uses it really well because it is always for those moments. So it is, like you said, when John kind of skids caught between the two of them and the Terminators get down and shoots at the T-1000, or when Sarah sees the Terminator, and if you've seen the first movie, you know the baggage she's carrying with that, and she just literally collapses to the floor and like, oh God, it's happening kind of thing. So yeah, it heightens those dramatic moments, I think, a lot better. But anyway, that's kind of slightly off topic, but I did want to sort of briefly talk about, obviously the difference this time is that you have two Terminators. And Arnie being the good guy became so popular that it was what they went with in every future film. You won't hear me mention those very often, but sadly they do exist. It's an undeniable fact. Man, you know when they ask you those questions, like if there's any films you'd like to erase from history?
Yeah.
Every Terminator movie after two.
Yeah, I get that. I get that vibe.
But yeah. So yeah, the difference this time, obviously the Terminators, I can't remember where this quote came from, but somebody in the production had said, well, if the T-800 series is kind of a human Panzer tank, then the T-1000 series had to be a Porsche. So it was, you know, that was why they cast Robert Patrick instead of somebody big and bulky or whatever that they were thinking about for a while. And, you know, he said he'd studied the movement of like predatory animals and eagles and how to run without looking like you're exerting any effort or breathing heavily or anything, and it really comes off. I think it's very effective. So yeah, and with regards to the T-1000, it appears as a police officer because apparently they thematically believed that that represented humans who should have empathy for others becoming more machine-like and detached from their emotions. So in a way, it's kind of a sly comment on law enforcement. One of the kind of tragic things about this is that the bar where they filmed the opening sequence with the T-800, it's the same bar where the Rodney King beatings happened, like a week after they'd finished filming, which is deeply ironic. And, you know, there's that moment in the film where the SWAT team at Cyberdyne Systems just bursts in and shoots Miles Dyson, you know, sight unseen, not a word of warning, you know, because he's a black guy, presumably. Whereas, you know, they've given the T-800 countless warnings when he turns up, even with miniguns and stuff, but they just blow Dyson away. And I think that, again, potentially relates to, you know, a sly undercurrent that I'd never noticed until this particular viewing of, like, yeah, this is criticizing humans who are doing jobs where they should have more empathy and yet still don't.
Well, so, I mean, you've got to give a shout out to John Connor's friend who basically saved the human race by just not trusting a cop. No, I ain't seen
it. Yeah, well, that guy should have been arrested for the crime that was that hair, but other...
Hey, it's a ginger mullet. You know, there is nothing that can outplay that in a deck of cards.
Oh. There's two words you should never put together.
I do find it interesting that while a central point in this movie is that phrase, there is no fate but what we make for ourselves. Mm. And it all reverts to a scene in The Terminator, and yet that scene from the original was deleted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah. We talked about it, though, when we mentioned our review, because they also deleted the plot line, which they're kind of presumably glad that they did delete, because it formed the bulk of this, which was that they had that subplot where they were trying to find out Cyberdyne systems and, you know, blow it up. And I think it was Kyle was trying to talk Sarah out of it or vice versa. But yeah, they'd had that idea already and were like, no, we'll cut that out. And then, like I said, if you hadn't done that, hadn't cut that, you wouldn't have all of this stuff here, which I think works a heck of a lot better. So,
and they were also going to have, you know, he wanted to put that the T-1000 in at the end of the original, but couldn't do it because of budget constraints and limits of technology. I believe he considered using clay animation in dark surroundings. it was supposed to be a last resort, as even Skynet apparently was reluctant to send the T-1000, as it was experimental and could potentially cause more damage to the timeline than good. But yeah, as you say, both that and the Cyberdyne plotline was scrubbed from the original. But I do like that, because to me, this is just the other half of that story. It's not written as a sequel for sequel's sake, if you know what I mean. It is a definitive end to that story. It's just chapter two. And I think that's why this one holds up, because it's... Yeah, the first one was a great standalone movie, but this is the original creator coming back to it and just saying, no, I want to finish... I can't believe I'm standing up for Cameron like this. I want to finish the movie as I want to finish it, and that's fine. And I think if studios hadn't been so money-grubbing, this would have been a perfect, you know, duology.
Oh, completely. Because like I said, the way that it ends, I think, is it ends in such a way that there's no need for a sequel.
No.
Even if you're just counting the original ending, which is kind of the one that, like I said, I go with. The alternate ending leaves no room for a sequel. So,
well, this is the thing. Apparently, Cameron wanted that ending. Mm. He wanted to put a definitive point on it. But Mario Casar said, no, we want that other one, because we want to be able to set it up for a sequel. In the end, Cameron obviously relented. And I do like the theatrical ending. I love it. I think it's incredibly ambiguous, and it throws it out to the audience as if to say, be better.
Yeah, and I think I like it better because it really emphasizes the fact that it's Sarah's restored, like, faith and hope and all these things that they're not tangible. So she's like, yeah, the future, we still don't actually know what it's going to be like, but at least now I can look upon it more hopefully, which for me is a better ending than, and this great future is different. And it's like, oh, well, okay.
Yeah.
But, and plus, I just think the alternate ending is deeply cheesy. It's one of those, like, no, let's just not go there. So, I mean,
it's,
I may as well,
like,
mention
what
it
Back
is.
To the Future.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, it's, I get it, but yeah. So, like I said, this is basically the main change in the Ultimate Edition, if you've got the DVD and Blu-ray, is the tacked on sort of this new ending. And it is that it basically ends several years in the future, and it reveals that Sarah Connor is alive, and John Connor is apparently fighting his war differently now in the Senate. So he's become a senator, and he's, you know, passing laws to prevent all of these weapons and things. And Sarah's there playing with her granddaughter, who presumably is John's child. And Judgment Day has never come to pass, and everything's great and glorious, and that's the end. And again, I just find that cheesy and very much too much of a, like, and we're putting a bow on it. And like, oh, I don't love it.
I'm as guilty as anyone for, you know, loving a happy ending despite my being British, but I do love the ambiguity of the ending that we get. It's kind of definitive at the same time, you know. It's not. I do like the fact that it leaves it open for a sequel. I just wish they'd not taken them up on it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. The thing is, they probably could have made a good sequel, but they just didn't. They kept on focusing on all the wrong things. But regardless, yeah, like I said, and just for argument's sake, apparently it was James Cameron that decided against that ending. Eventually, because he said it didn't fit the dark, gloomy atmosphere of the rest of the movie, which is why they went with the actual theatrical ending as well. So, yeah. So the question that I wanted to ask specifically now then is, obviously we know the main plot is kind of just a reversal of the first movie, so it's once again Skynet are sending, you know, someone through time to try and kill John Connor himself this time, as opposed to Sarah before he's born. And once again, the Resistance have sent someone, and so it's a T-800 that's reprogrammed. And there's not really a lot we can say about that. Like you say, it is just, it's the plot from the first movie, but at least they had the sense to change it up a little bit and make it a bit different and switch the roles so that the T-1000 initially seems more human, and then the machine actually, the Terminator turns out to be more human and becomes the surrogate father figure and whatever. So it does something interesting with that. Did you think the same way, or did you feel that they'd, you know, they just copied themselves?
To an extent, but it's, I think it's one of the critical, you know, rules of a sequel. If it's not broke, don't fix it. Give the audience what they want, but it's a sequel, so bigger and better, if you know what I mean. And I think he ticked all of those boxes. It's, it is very similar, but rather than just rehashing it, he did that thing where, you know, it plays with your expectation, obviously, unless you know, it's been pissed on by marketing. You know, it plays with your expectations. It adds other elements, you know, it brings John into it itself. It's not just a, you know, a Sarah and her protector. And she doesn't need a protector this time. She's actually the badass in this one. And it just kind of, it kind of tweaks it, and I think it ups the ante a bit, because at the end of the day, it's still, in essence, a kind of, yeah, it's an action film, but it's a chase movie. It's really tense, and you're wanting, obviously, the protagonist to escape, and it just, I think, kind of ups it a little.
Mm. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I kind of agree, like I said, but I also like what they did. Like I said, I can't really say enough about how clever it was, and how much I love this comment that the Terminator itself turns out to be the best possible father for John.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why there's some scenes, which I'll get into later, but there's scenes that are cut, which I think emphasize that a little bit more and explain that a bit better in kind of geeky sci-fi terms. But yeah, in any case, I like that there is that difference. One of the things I did want to ask you about, because I personally think it's really clever and not necessarily something I would have thought out, but what do you think about where the storyline places Sarah at the start of this movie? Because obviously time has passed in between, and we learn a little bit about what she's been up to, but obviously it makes such logical sense in a way that naturally she ended up in, you know, an insane asylum. And what they do with that, having her in there and, you know, fighting against that system, is so interesting to me in such a weird, like, they didn't have to make that choice. They could have had her being, you know, oh, I'm clever enough to have stayed on the run and I'm still a qualifier somewhere. But I think this is so much more interesting. And I was curious how you felt about that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you could have had her, you know, just shopping for dresses in New Mexico and stuff like that. And just, you know, on the down low. And I think it was a fantastic choice to have her actually incarcerated in this, because it would, that's what would happen.
Oh, absolutely. And
I think she plays that brilliantly, and I think it adds an interesting little dimension to the story. It's you know, there's two concurrent things going along. Obviously, you know, you're trying to protect John from the T-1000, but then, you know, you've got this I'm not going to say subplot because they're equally as important, but you've got this other plot line running along where the protagonist from the first one is in dire straits through basically no fault of her own by telling the truth, and how she deals with that and how they cope with it, you know, as an ensemble.
Yeah, completely. And it's a clever bit of continuity that they bring back Earl Bowen as Dr. Silverman from the first movie.
Yeah.
I just think it's a nice world building. It wasn't necessary, but it adds a little bit more. And just random geek trivia, in case it ever comes up on a pub quiz or anything, that Earl Bowen is the only actor other than Schwarzenegger to appear in all of the first three Terminator films. So, yeah.
I couldn't say whether he appears in the third one. I've only ever watched the third one all the way through once and then vowed never again. I liked the ending that we got in this, and I would have been happy to just leave it behind as this perfect little two-film saga and have it. Yeah. But obviously, when they make money, you can't have that, and this is why we can't have nice things.
I suppose. But I think there's such a well-built world here and everything, though, that I don't blame them for returning to it. And like I said, if you watch the Sarah Connor Chronicles, there was a way to do that and return to that world without, you know, sullying the first two movies and tell a very good story. I would recommend you watch it if you get the chance, with the proviso that it does end on an incredibly frustrating "we're going to cancel you" cliffhanger, which really annoys me. As you well know, there's nothing worse than when you're really enjoying something. And so it got two great seasons and ended on a massive, huge cliffhanger that has mass huge repercussions and then just stops because it got cancelled. And I don't think that story's been picked up anywhere, which, again, very annoying. But, yeah, there's things in that really extend the world and build out the world that are so cool. But no, I mean, moving us slightly along from that, I did want to talk about because you said there's lots of plots going on in this film, including, you know, where Sarah is, where everyone kind of picks up and the chase, as it were, just like the first movie. But one of the big things that the film does, which I love, is that it also deals with Judgment Day itself. And you get the idea of, you know, they have to destroy Cyberdyne systems, and this particular character who's the most important person to that, the Miles Dyson character. Yeah. And, you know, everything involved with that, from kind of Sarah's moral quandary to his turn to, you know, realizing what he's going to do and destroying it, to even the idea that, like, these movies, and this is such an underrated thing that gets overlooked, these movies are a massive predestination paradox, because...
Yeah.
Cyberdyne are reverse engineering the technology from the first movie, from the Terminator that was chasing Sarah. So, again, if you actually think about it, the sheer head trip of, like, so the Resistance sent something back to ensure the future, which then it's the only reason that the future happened, was because they sent something back so that it was, you know, it's proper full-on time travel stuff, but nobody really, because it's sort of well hidden in this, you know, good action movie, and it doesn't bog you down with the specifics of it. It's just base level. Makes sense. Let's not worry about it.
Yeah.
I think it worked really well. So what do you think about all this kind of Dyson Cyberdyne
predestination? I think that was really, really well done. I did like the kind of Chekhov's gun setup, because apart from that little scene at the start where it goes into the lockup and you see the arm and the chip and stuff, you get so caught up in them trying to evade the T-1000. You get so caught up in, you know, Sarah trying to escape from the institution, that you completely forget about that until you're like two-thirds into the movie, and, you know, it comes out about Dyson, and the next thing you know, she's off to kill Dyson.
Yeah.
And it just, it's one of those, I mean, yes, you will always get plot holes in films, but this is, to me, as close to a movie with zero plot holes you can get, because they make a consistent effort to try and get everything addressed, and I do like that. It bugs me that there's still a Terminator arm in the steel mill.
Other than that, my mother spotted that the first time we watched this together, and she's never shut up about it for like 30 years ever since, because she's so thoroughly convinced she's smarter than the filmmakers, and like, but there's still an arm there. There's still left one there.
Like, yeah, I just, part of me today was thinking, I'm sure when they walked back, they discovered it and thought, yeah, we'll get rid of that as well. And again, it's headcanon, it's hand waving it away, but.
I just considered it that the arm itself really wasn't as relevant as the chip.
Yeah.
Now, the weird thing is that they have a chip from the first arm, which seems to imply that's where it was held. And yet Arnie quite clearly says the chip in him is in his head. So again, it's a little baffling, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe the original one had its chip in the arm for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's Yeah. Other than that, I do like how it just tries to. It just seems to be this film is a lot of about tying up loose ends, and that's why I love it as a sequel. Because, as I mentioned earlier, it is just part two. If this was a novel, this would be, you know, book two. And I just, I just get that vibe. It wasn't there just as a cash grab. Well, not on Cameron's part.
No.
It was there because the story needed to be finished, being told. And like, you know, he did with The Abyss, he didn't want to do it. And like he did with Avatar, apparently, didn't want to do it until the effects had caught up with what he needed to do. The effects caught up, he did it, and he tried his very best to tie everything up. And I love that about this film. It doesn't pander. It doesn't try and set itself up for a sequel. It doesn't, you know, despite that ending, it's not advertising something coming down the pipeline, and that's what we're used to these days. A lot of movies, especially in a franchise, are just there to set up the following movie. And this, you don't get that vibe from this. Even now, even though, you know, there's like four pieces of crap that follow it, you think, yeah, this is it.
For sure. And I think that there's, like you said, not just the lack of plot holes, but such clever writing in terms of, you know, like I said, where everybody is now, or the idea that even though it's kind of, you know, you say it's kind of got a dark atmosphere, James Cameron, but it's very much, unlike the first movie, it's very much like, you know, you exist in terms of a being with free will. You can change the future. Anything can be done. You'll end it with hope. And that whole kind of no fate but what you make message is, you know, it is telling you you've got control over this thing. Which I like. Just a few things I kind of wanted to go with in terms of, like I said, just to emphasize how good I think the writing is. It's very ahead of its time in regards to the growth of AI that we're currently seeing, and the idea of Skynet, you know, becoming self-aware and realizing, you know, humans are a threat to it, so it just took them out. It's so weird how prescient that became, and not just now. I mean, it's come back around again now, but ever since, for, like I said, like 3.5 decades, it's been a genuine concern. So every time you do hear about this AI and this learning technology, the film is so influential that you can almost certainly hear somebody going like, is that, do you want Skynet? Because that's how you get Skynet.
Yeah.
And it's a message that I think it's important to hear, which is, again, a surprisingly deep thing. And I think in Terminator 2 particularly, there's also a very strong anti-war message. You know, the scene of the kids playing with guns, and then John saying, you know, we're doomed, basically. The Terminator, you're destined to destroy yourselves. Or Sarah's just horrific visions of, like, what a nuclear blast will do to you.
I literally cannot watch the screen when that's on.
Oh, it's awful. But, like, in the most brutal, like, the most effective way, it's powerful, but it does the job. And for me, again, it's like, because that's the point in the film where she has to turn from, I have to be more proactive. It's not just about protecting John to survive in, you know, to defeat the machines. I have to actually defeat Judgment Day, because she's saying, like, yeah, okay, I've protected my son, but, like, this horrible thing is still going to happen, and I can prevent it. So, you know,
with the best one in the world, with, you know, with what she went through in the first film, yes, they lock her up because of, you know, she's been telling everybody what actually happened. But when you look at the fact that this woman's been suffering from nightmares, like the one that she has in this film, anybody would end up in an institution. For her to end up there and still be as sane as she is, is a testament to the character.
Oh, yeah. And I'll get into that when we talk a little bit about the acting and stuff. But yeah, I want to try and finish this, because we're taking way too long for just two.
Yeah.
We've got a lot we can say about the movie, I know. So I like that, again, unlike the first movie, it cleverly uses the idea that the T-1000 imitates a cop to get straight to John, just use the police scanner thing. Yeah. Like, hey, that's so clever. The first movie, you had to have the T-800 scrolling the phone book for every Sarah Connor and stuff. And it's like, in this one, nope, just imitated a cop, type it in the machine, he's there, you know, plot, we're done. It's a plot shortcut, but it's one that makes absolute sense in universe, and so you've got to applaud it. Or
there's that thing in that scene as well where he puts his hand on top of the computer, almost like he assumes he's going to communicate with the cop computer just by touch.
Terminator 3 territory again there, though.
yeah, it's a hello computer.
Yeah, bear in mind this was pre sort of the takeoff of the internet, so we didn't really have any of that going on, but Yeah, but I like that the script introduces us to the main players really fast. I always complain about films that have bad pacing, and I think this is a perfect example of a film that has fantastic pacing, because it introduced straight away to the two Terminators, to John, to where Sarah is, and it's all out of the way and done within like 20 minutes, and you know where everybody is, and you're set up. There's no dawdling, which is, again, an ironic thing to say about James, let's make a four-hour movie, Cameron, but...
Yeah.
I wish he'd learned this lesson in Avatar instead of let's stare at leaves for 35 minutes before we meet anyone.
They were very pretty leaves, though, let's be fair.
But yeah, the only other thing I wanted to mention, again, just silly little things, but I love the moment where Dyson is only saved because his son happens to knock into him with a little remote control truck. It's the kind of thing I'm like, I wish I had the genius to think of a bit of writing like that, of like, she would have went through with it, but he was just saved by dumb coincidence.
Yeah.
It's so cool. Or the little moment where the T-1000 sort of blobs its way through the grate, but forgets the gun. So the gun just clinks behind and he has to kind of, again, it's just such a little moment, but it's so genius of like, oh, come on. It's just brilliant. Yeah. I love it. And in terms of, I know there's a lot of funny lines and stuff, but my favorite funny line, it's not my favorite line in the movie, but my favorite funny line is definitely, we've got company, the cops, how many? All of them, I thought.
Yeah, I was laughing at that one earlier. Yeah. I do have a note here. The Hasta la Vista, baby. In the Spanish version, it's sayonara, sayonara, baby. Yeah.
To keep with the idea that it's a little different.
Yeah.
I did read that was also put in the script because it was how Cameron and Wisher would end every phone call.
Oh, dear.
Apparently. So, yeah. And I should talk briefly about the idea that, again, I love that the film doesn't shy away from having a bit more respect for human life. So the idea that John's like, well, you can't just kill everyone. And the humor you get of like, he'll live or casualties 0.0 is really good. And even funnier when you know the backstory. I don't know if you were going to mention this about like Schwarzenegger was really annoyed because he and Stallone had this ongoing bet of like who'd have the biggest body count in their movies. And so Schwarzenegger comes out of Terminator 2 with a body count of 0. Yeah. And he was incredibly annoyed, but then had to admit that like for the story, it made so much more sense. And I think James Cameron, when he heard about this bet, was like, that's such a stupid bet with such disregard for life. I'm going to deliberately make you not kill anybody.
I think they picked up on that later on in Schwarzenegger's Last Action Hero, where Schwarzenegger's playing himself at a premiere. And he says, and we kill less people in this movie. In the last movie, we killed 68. In this one, we only kill 19. And it just reminded me of that, where he's like, you know, trying to just scare the cops away with the chain gun.
But I love that. Yeah.
Going back to your earlier point, I do agree with that, with the anti-war message. And that's why I think this is just such a perfect ending. Because it sows those seeds through, as you say, with the, you know, the kids shooting and what John says. And then at the end, with the line that Sarah says, and it pretty much the movie just kind of stops dead. Once the Terminator's, you know, lowered into the steel, it just kind of stops by going on to that scene with the traveling down the road. And then that line, and it's as if to say, all right, this is what we say about it. It's over to you now to do better, as it were. Yeah. And I loved that ending. And I just think if it would have just been kept at that ending, you don't have to continually hammer a point home to make it. And I think this movie makes it perfectly.
Yeah, I'll mention that later for sure and come back to it. But for now, I want to move us away from the writing, unless you've got anything you wanted to mention about the writing and the plot.
No, I've gone through everything that I had, mate. See, so smooth, it all just went in there. I mean, yeah, the conversation's about 40 minutes long, but it's there.
That's fine. So the next thing then that I have on my list to look at would be the acting. So do you have any sort of BTS notes?
Oh,
or anything about that?
So much. Yeah. The first choice to play the T-1000, do you want to guess?
You've already told me it was Michael Biehn.
After that.
Oh, okay. It wasn't O.J. Simpson again, was it?
It was Billy Idol.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. He was cast, actually, and then had to drop out.
Yeah, ironically enough, he got injured in a motorcycle accident, which prevented him from doing it. Cameron then cast Robert Patrick. after seeing him in Die Hard 2, Patrick undertook a rigorous running regime and practiced breathing only through his nose in order to appear as a cyborg that could run at high speeds. He trained so hard that he was able to catch up to Edward Furlong and his dirt bike with ease. Schwarzenegger, going on to the other Terminator, as an incentive to get on board with this, Mario Casar gave him a Gulfstream 3 airplane.
That was the majority of his fee, apparently. Yeah,
yeah, worth about $40 million for accepting. Yeah. It's
imagine that, man. What did you get for your pay? I got a Gulfstream jet.
Yeah. In total, he got $15 million. And his total of with a total of 700 words of dialogue, so he was paid on average $21,429 per word. Hasta la vista, baby. Cost of production $85,000. So, Linda Hamilton, she joked that she experienced excruciating moments when she was forced to listen to Schwarzenegger give Furlong advice about women and stated that they did so well together on screen because emotionally they were the same age. She turned down a part in another movie after hearing a simple outline of the plot by Cameron. Her only condition was that Connor's character should have evolved, no longer being the meek and feeble waitress. She wanted to be crazy. She learned to pick locks for the scene in the mental hospital, where she does precisely that with a paperclip. She received weapons training from a former Israeli commando, a personal physical trainer for 3 hours a day, 6 days a week for 13 weeks before filming. She trained intensively with weapons and weights and learned judo and heavy military training techniques. She had to maintain a demanding non-fat diet, even during filming. She lost 12 pounds. And after training, she was able to impress Cameron by hitting every mark with a machine gun on the shooting range, despite having no experience with weapons before the training. And she also got called out by Schwarzenegger for looking incredibly ripped, apparently.
Yeah. She said since that she wishes she looked like she did then now, because it was the best she's ever looked, and peak physical fitness, and yes.
You can't argue with that, yeah.
Yeah.
Her twin sister, as you mentioned earlier, was used as a double in the scene involving two Sarah Connors, and a scene not in the theatrical release, but on the DVD is a mirror image of Linda. Mm.
That's one of the scenes I wanted to mention. So, yeah, it's when she's working on the chip to get it out of Arnie's head, and so obviously you have the reflection, and it's not Arnold, it's the Stan Winston. Looking way more convincing, it's a Stan Winston thing, but instead of a reflection, you've got her twin working on the Stan Winston dummy maquette head and Linda working on, you know, the back of Arnold Schwarzenegger's head.
Yeah.
And there's no actual mirror there. It's so clever.
They did fantastic on this. This was the film debut of Edward Furlong. He won the part after being discovered by casting director Mally Finn. She'd been looking for a streetwise kid, but none of the professional actors who come for a screen test have been convincing enough. She actually looked to a boys' club of Pasadena, where she found Furlong. When she approached him, he gave apparently the correct amount of attitude, convincing her that he could be perfect for the role. The production, actually, though, it took so long that Furlong's growth caused the production team to have to make certain adjustments. He's noticeably younger in the desert scene than in other scenes, and his voice began to break. So the majority of the dialogue was pitch adjusted in post-production.
Recorded as ADR, I read as well.
His voice, as recorded, was left intact only in the scene where he and the Terminator are talking about why people cry, because Cameron wanted it to sound dramatic and thought the original audio was better. He also grew quite a bit over the months that, for one scene shot late in the production, he had to stand in a hole in the ground in order to maintain continuity and height difference with Linda.
Yeah,
and
that's quite common in Hollywood, to be fair. Anyone that's acted has probably had to do that anyway.
It is. I actually walked into my parents last night as they were watching Runaway Bride, where Richard Gere is considerably taller than Julia Roberts, and even my dad was like going, "Yeah, get lost." And finally, yeah, Denzel Washington was offered the role of Miles Dyson. He turned it down, though. He says, "No offense to Jim Cameron, but when I read the script, I thought all he does is look scared and sweat. I had to pass."
I have to say, I love Denzel Washington, but I think he's dead wrong about that. I think they've already described in certain places that Dyson is the most human character in the film and the true heart of it. And that what he goes through in the movie, from kind of realizing what he's done and what he's brought into existence, to the moral switch, to, you know, getting completely shot to bits, to ultimately, you know, heroically sacrificing himself as a martyr for the cause, it's rich as heck. And I can't understand how Denzel could read that and just think, oh, all I've got to do is run away and be scared. It's a fantastic role.
And I think Joe Martin's a very underrated actor. He did brilliant in this.
He seems to have a career out of making cyborgs, though.
Oh, God, yeah. I just remember him as the one of the one things in Blues Brothers 2000 that was actually good.
Oh, I remember him as one of the only things in Zack Snyder's Justice League that was any good.
Oh, God, that's he was I'm in that. I just absolutely completely forgot.
That's what I'm referring to. He's
Simon. Oh, I thought you were on about Eureka.
No. I mean, that's part of it. But that's what I mean. Like, his career seems to be 90% I create cyborgs. So, yeah. I mean, that was a pretty clever bit of casting when I first appeared in Batman v Superman, actually, when Cyborg's dad appears. And I'm like, it's flipping Miles Dyson.
Yeah.
Have you not learned not to screw with cyborgs? So, yeah, I mean, was that all you had on the acting?
That's all my notes on the acting, mate.
I think I've kind of touched on most of the stuff that already in some areas, but I will say, I think Arnie in this film is really good. I'm not saying he justifies the level of pay he got necessarily, but if you look at, like, he has very little to do other than be menacing in that first movie. And here I'm thoroughly convinced of him as the, like, learning about humanity and the father figure and... You know, even the "I now know why you cry" and the legendary thumbs up that you have as your avatar there.
Yeah.
Could have come off terrible and cheesy, but for me, just really works. It emphasizes that Schwarzenegger can act when you give him the stuff and the right motivation, you know?
It's I can't believe I'm saying this. It's an incredibly understated performance. When you consider that for Arnie, that is something. He's a good actor, and I just... He's perfect in this. And yes, since then we've had... I mean, it's due to the fact that a lot of the lines are iconic. But, you know, with apologies to the late, great Steve Wright, we then had, you know, the song Arnie and the Terminators, I'll Be Back, which kind of put a lot of Arnie's lines from this into the lexicon and treated it with kind of a comedy filter.
Right.
But when you watch this, he comes off as incredibly convincing. And, we often say it when it's a film that we recognise is good, but it's no less true here. I don't think there's a single performer in this that lets it down.
No, and I would actually say there's some career highlights performances amongst them as well. Not least, like I said, Schwarzenegger, it's one of his at least top three performances. And like you say, just everything understated. He could easily have milked things like, you know, "I need a vacation" for every laugh it was worth, but he doesn't. He kind of trusts the material, I think, in moments like that. And the humor, the daftness of, like, learning what to say, or finally seeing hasta la vista when he blows it away, or the half smile, and just little things, it works really well for me. And talking of career best performances, I don't think Linda Hamilton's been better than she was in this movie either.
No.
And when you look at it, there's a reason it's become, along with Sigourney Weaver's Ellen Ripley, it's the go-to, like, female empowerment action hero performance. And it is that good. It cannot be understated. It became iconic because it is just that flippin' brilliant. It's fantastic. And the sheer change from, you know, the meek, you know, 80s perm waitress in the pink dress from the first movie to this absolute badass in this movie.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And it's not just between movies. There are scenes in this where, and I'm not talking about the one where Silberman's interviewing her and she's, you know, putting this front on to try and get into that minimum security wing. But later on where they're explaining to Dyson what's happening, she sat behind there smoking a cigarette and stuff like that. And then she starts getting onto this rant about, you know, you're the men that created the hydrogen bomb and all you know how to do is make things that they destroy. She can turn on a dime in this. But
I was going to say it. I was going to mention that similar scene. Like I said, the fact that she's like the whole point of her in the film is that like the T-800 in a way is a better human than she is. So she's now cold and detached and machine-like and got this mission. And it seems that that's very much what she's doing when she goes to kill Dyson and very nearly does. And one of my favorite moments in the movie, just because it's such a brilliantly acted scene, is when she almost kills him and then doesn't. And then just falls back and collapses against. And then when John catches up with her, she's just kind of like, I almost, and she just can't quite believe what nearly happened. And but she didn't lose her humanity in that moment. And it's like, that is so rich and so deep and so difficult to act as well.
It's almost, it is. And, you know, I don't mean this in derogatory terms, but it's almost schizophrenic in the approach to acting, because she's had 10 years of this utter freaking nightmare. It's gonna pull anyone's sanity to their limits. Yeah. And she's obviously, you know, she's getting very little sleep. She daren't sleep. She's under this tremendous pressure that nobody even believes, let alone is on her side with. And she's at the end of her rope. And she just plays it brilliantly.
Yeah. And it comes down that scene, I think, to something James Cameron said, which is that he said, ultimately, it's a question of what is humanity worth if you abandon it to win the battle for its existence. And that was kind of, I think, Sarah's motivation, not necessarily in those words, but that was why she didn't go through with it. Because I think there may be some people who complain about it and like, well, why didn't she just do it? It would have kind of, and that's the reason why she would have, it would have sacrificed her humanity. And yeah, at what point are you the machine in that scenario?
Yeah.
So I love that. I love all of that.
It's astonishing to me that she didn't get better roles after this.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. And well, yeah, I was going to say something about Dark Fate there, but I won't. It's not her fault, bless her. So, yeah. But never mind. And I mean, for having zero acting experience, Edward Furlong's really good. I mean, he's not fantastic. He certainly isn't the best thing in this, but he's not precocious or annoying or anything.
Oh, I don't know. When I watched it when I was younger, I hated the little shit. At the start, when he's you know, easy money and all that kind of stuff, it's just like this obnoxious little there are reasons, obviously, but there were times when I first watched this back then that I thought, what an annoying, slimy little turd. I've kind of grown with it as over the years, so I do like it. But for a first performance, I think it's this is the occasional, but I don't think it lets it down at all. I mean, and when you look at it, he's acting with Schwarzenegger. I mean, these people are heavyweights in this kind of genre thing.
Acting, he's carrying the scenes with Schwarzenegger. He's the one leading the scene of like, oh, you can't kill, and this is why, you know, you've got to say things like this, and this is how you blend in. And it's kind of like, yeah, he's carrying this actor of way more experience, you know?
He does really well. And again, it's a shame he didn't have more after this. I mean, I think the only thing that I've watched with him in, and don't get me wrong, it's right in my wheelhouse, was some band I love. It was, I think, a horror movie called Brain Scan with a killer video game or something. And,
I don't know, he was one of the many people that's made a Crow movie. Unfortunately,
poor guy.
Yeah. Oh dear.
Yeah, talking about films that have no rights having crappy sequels.
Well, yeah. But no, I mean, he's very good. But again, it's annoying to me because I think a lot of his best stuff is in the special edition version, and it was cut from the film. When you really start to see him mature and grow into the role of the military leader he's going to be. Which is a shame, but, you know, it's a long movie, I guess, so what can you do?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've already talked about almost everyone else. I've talked about Robert Patrick and how good he is at the kind of predatory thing. Talked about Joe Morton, just how good that role, I think, is, unlike Denzel. And the only other thing I wanted to mention is a couple of small roles, but it's small but effective, and it's Xander Berkeley and Jeanette Goldstein, returning from Aliens, who are playing John's foster parents. Not a huge role, but really good in what they have to do, especially Jeanette when she has to imitate the T-1000 in that one scene.
Yeah.
Which is so cool. Except every time I'm just like, so was the T-1000 just going to make dinner? Like, is it that like good of an infiltrator that it was just like, no, well, I've got to make dinner for this jerk while I wait on the sun ringing, so I guess I'll just get on with it. Yeah. Anyway, any other thoughts on the acting then?
No, like I said, I don't think there's a single performance in this that lets it down. And there isn't, you know, on top of that, I go back to what I said earlier, there's not a single performance in this where those giving the performance take the material as less than 100%.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll move to the directing, and do you have anything about this from the BTS perspective?
Just a couple. There was a concern to how realistic the CGI would be when it came to the helicopter going under the underpass. So the pilot just did it for real. However, the camera crew refused to film it because of the risks involved. So Cameron just thought, balls to this, and filmed it himself twice. Once with the camera car driving behind the helicopter and once in front of it. The scene where the Terminator reboots after being shut down was not in the script and was only added during editing because Cameron felt that the audience wouldn't be able to understand how the Terminator returns to deliver the final blow to the T-1000. According to the Schwarzenegger book, The Life and Times, Cameron contacted Schwarzenegger, who was off to visit friend Bruce Willis for Christmas, and called him back to shoot that scene. Ultimately, Schwarzenegger had to cancel his plans and film it, so the scene where the Terminator pulls the impaled metal rod out was actually shot on Christmas Day. Ooh. And, further on from that, in the final scene, the line, "I cannot self-terminate, you must lower me into the steel," they were added by Schwarzenegger in post-production. Originally, the Terminator silently gave Sarah the controls for the winch, but the test audiences didn't understand why the Terminator couldn't just drop himself into the steel. And, as we've spoken previously about Cameron, working with him wasn't the best of times. It was so hard on so many crew members that they all started wearing T-shirts bearing the slogan, "Terminator 3, not with me."
Oh, and similarly T-shirts that bore the slogan, "You can't scare me, I work for Jim Cameron."
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, so, man. I mean, he's good, but he's, by all accounts, an absolute jerk to try and work
with. Oh, God, yeah. He's arrogant. He's a hack. As a perfectionist, these are all... I think he is. These are all things I've... Dude, Avatar, come on. These are all things that I've... I've leveled at him in the past. But when you look at films like this and, you know, Aliens, you just can't fault them. This especially. I think this is just... It's better than anything else he's done.
And I see what you're saying, because as much as I would say I'm a huge fan of James Cameron, I kind of acknowledge that I'm not as big a fan of James Cameron as James Cameron is. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, yeah. All right. I think there's a level of perfectionism that, like you said, annoys other people, but speaks for itself in terms of...
Oh, gosh, definitely. If he'd have not done what he had done, if he'd not been the person that he is, we wouldn't have such great movies. I just wish we could see maybe a kind of return to that Cameron rather than just keep making sequels,
right? Yeah,
as he is now.
As you said, learning the wrong lesson and over-relying on things like CGI now, which is just like, all right, you know.
Yeah.
Like you said, Terminator 2, groundbreaking CGI, but an awful lot of just really well-done stunts and action as well. And I miss that. You know, the Avatar movies, even when they do have action scenes, just feel like a computer game.
Yeah. I mean, the first Avatar... I can see that. I kind of think, yeah, get it out of your system and kind of move on. But it's kind of like he's not wanting to move on anymore. And it's such a shame because although as pretty as the Avatar films are, the first one might have had a message. But now you're just hammering that point home, which in essence is like what we've talked about with the Terminator sequels. Whereas the you know, original story got that point across quite succinctly. And then you could just, you know, perhaps move on and do something else with your time. And yeah. I think when, in the grand scheme of things, when people look back on James Cameron movies, they'll rightly put Avatar alongside his others, but it will only be the first Avatar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, talking about the direction, I did have a couple of things I wanted to bring up as well, which is, I've mentioned during our 2001 review this word auteur,
and whatever you think of James Cameron, I do think he's a director, a modern director that you could classify as an auteur, which is to say he has recognizable things in every one of his films and touches that you can sort of, some more than others, but some that you can point to and say, oh, it's a James Cameron thing. And for me, some of the ones that are evident here are, as I mentioned, the use of like blue lightning for, you know, the various special effects, the time pops and stuff, the actual blue lighting and hue in various moments, the future war sort of heavily special effects laden scenes, the use of slow-mo but only for like emotional moments, and just the way the action's directed, I think is quite Cameron-esque at times as well. And yeah, Cameron shot the movie with two colors used as lighting and filtering, orange and blue. Orange was the color of humanity and blue was the color of machines. This was brought to a head in the Steel Mill finale, where humanity and the humanized Terminator makes its final stand against the machines. The orange hues of the molten steel, which would destroy the machines, was filmed opposite of the cold blue of the machinery around it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just little things like the Terminator begins the film wearing leather and sunglasses, riding a motorbike. He loses the sunglasses and bike around the hospital escape. This was a deliberate reversal of the original film, in which he only acquires these things past the midway point, and to symbolize the opposite moral journeys of the two versions of the cyborg. Over a week, Cameron spent several hours each day choreographing vehicle scenes with toy cars and trucks, which I love because I used to do that as a kid. He would film the results.
As a kid? Dude, I'm under no impressions that stopped.
Shh. But yeah, unlike me playing with my Megazords, he would film the results and print the footage for storyboard artists. There was no time to properly test practical effects before filming, so if effects didn't work, the filmmakers had to just work around them. So yeah, other than that, I've just got a few notes that I've made of things that I like, which is, man, that viaduct chase. I don't know if that's what you would call it, a viaduct. You know what I mean, right?
The riverbed.
Storm drain or whatever you call it. Yeah, that whole scene is just, oh, it's just amazing.
I do like the little story of when they were filming that, Cameron asking Schwarzenegger, with regards to the bike, can you turn the bike quicker than that? And Schwarzenegger just replying, not with me still on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And let's see, just little things like, I love the shot composition in various moments. I stopped looking after a while because I was enjoying the movie, but at the very start there's a couple of things that I noticed, which was Dyson being framed against the hand in shot, the Terminator cyborg hand is a fantastic scene. Or when it shows Silberman after Sarah's attacked him, and he kind of, to an aside to nobody, just looks around and goes, model citizen, and it's shown through a screen, the security camera screen, because he's almost breaking the fourth wall in that gag. And I'm like, oh, just brilliant. Just great work. I've mentioned a few other things. I like the chase from the hospital. The awesome little touches, like reabsorbing the little piece of the T-1000 where it's been cut off during that chase, the way that it makes like little, I don't know what you would call them, like little iron bars to try and climb up and stuff. Or,
yeah.
Yeah. And like I said already, the brutal nightmare vision. It's just so effective, and I do love the Black Highway at Night imagery for the kind of, you know, the future is not set. This is we now have hope. And one last thing, the way the camera views goes around the T-1000 when it's been blown up and views through the back of the hole that's been made in its head, which doesn't seem like much, but that's a difficult shot to pull off, man.
Oh yeah,
it's hard to film a hole through somebody's head that isn't there.
I've got to say, From the minute this started, I was impressed, and I wasn't, you know, get your glasses ready. I wasn't watching it in 4K, but the imagery, like for example, with the stylized imagery with the lighting in the truck stop where Patrick first appears, it's just beautiful. It's so crisp. The picture quality is just fantastic, and this is what blew me away. I'm thinking, my God, to consider how old this movie is now, and it is. It just looked like I said earlier, it just looks like it was filmed last week.
Yeah. One thing I didn't notice until watching it in 4K resolution is that the time bubbles that the two Terminators arrive in actually cause damage to the surroundings. So they cut out like a bit of the fence to either side in the circular.
I've always loved that.
I was like, oh, that's so cool. That's a cool little touch. But anyway, so that's all I have on the direction, because I've got a separate thing about VFX and production design. Yeah. Did you have anything else about direction?
No, I'm on to production design also.
Okay, I'm throwing it to you then for anything you've got on the behind the scenes of that one.
Yeah, well, oh my God, we've got a bit on this because, you know, what it makes up. ILM's computer graphics department had to grow from 6 artists to almost 36 to accommodate all the work required to bring the T-1000 to life. It cost $5.5 million and took 8 months to produce, which ultimately amounted to 3.5 minutes of screen time. Stan Winston and his crew studied hours of nuclear test footage in order to make Sarah Connor's nightmare scene look as realistic as possible. A miniature Los Angeles was made to simulate the scene. Some of the materials used in the miniature that mimicked all the destroyed masonry were crackers and shredded wheat. After each take, it would take an average 2 days to set the model up to shoot again. Now, in late 91, members of several US federal nuclear testing labs unofficially declared it the most accurate depiction of a nuclear blast ever created for a fictional motion picture. The special effects team members have stated several times that no scene they've worked on since has received an equivalent amount of praise or emotional feedback from viewers.
And somebody should have told Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, I think that's kind of held up with what we were saying earlier, that it's just horrific. Yeah, the effect of the T-1000 freezing and breaking was achieved by filming shots of an amputee fitted with prosthetics and of Robert Patrick with his real limbs buried underneath the set. Clever editing makes the effect appear almost seamless. To accomplish the scene in which the T-1000 slowly emerges from the fire, Robert Patrick had to stand in the centre of the flames and walk out. After the scene, his clothes were singed, but luckily he was all right. Damaged Terminator look, the climax of the film took 5 hours to apply and an hour to remove. And the steel mill effects were so convincing, some former workers from the plant, which had at that point been closed for over 10 years, thought it was up and running again. The artificial substance, which they used instead of melted steel, actually needed to be kept cool to maintain the right density. This meant that the temperature on set was quite cold, so the actors had to be sprayed with fake sweat in between takes. And the Terminator scene at the beginning of the movie were fully workable animatronic models. And again, this is going back to what we were saying. This is what I love about this. They used CGI when it was necessary. When it wasn't necessary, it was practical effects. And I always say, practical effects will always win out to me.
How good is that future war scene at the start of the film, though?
Yeah.
It's just incredible. I could watch an entire film of that. And, you know, not Salvation, because it wasn't that, which was a freaking huge letdown. But, you know, it's incredible. It was so good. And yeah. I don't have much else on the effects. You kind of talked about a lot of the things I had notes on. I like the very sort of almost basic but simplistic bullet effect shots on the T-1000, when it just sort of, if the bullet's hit it and it becomes a little sort of circle of liquid metal.
That's what I was talking about with Significant Other today, and we were saying... That is going to be the next cosplay. Next time we go to a con, I'm just getting a bunch of pie plates and sticking them to myself.
It's surprisingly effective. It looks just the same.
Yeah.
Anyway, but no, I love that effect. I love, obviously, the T-800 effect when it's messed up. Again, I think they're a vast improvement on the first movie, and they became iconic in their own right, I remember. The morphing effect of the T-1000 going into the helicopter seat, which is very The Abyss, but still very good.
It still looks beautiful, that one.
Looks amazing, yeah.
You look at it, and I don't know about you, but when I look at things like this, I always judge it from, obviously, a modern-day point of view, and thinking, this isn't going to hold up. This is, ooh, that's pretty.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason they made Terminator 2 3D Race Across Time, and it was a theme park attraction that lasted for years, because it just held up amazingly, and it looked great. But, I love the genius idea of the liquid nitrogen as like the partial thing that destroys the T-1000, because, again, just how did you think of it? And the way that it's filmed and the sort of gradually falls apart. Again, I kind of regret that we don't have the things that were cut from the scenes here, though, I'll
miss that one where he holds onto the railing and he kind of starts merging with the railing. I saw that on, I think that was my first experience with the special edition. It was on late one night on BBC One. And I saw that and I thought, I can't remember that. And
no,
it turned out it wasn't just my memory problems. It was, you know, just the fact that it was the special edition.
But no, that's one of the things I like is that, again, I'll talk about this part here. Once he's been kind of reformed after being blown apart with the liquid nitrogen freezing him, he starts to glitch terribly. So as you said, there's a very sort of nice scene where he touches a handlebar and his liquid metal mimics it and he has to kind of shake it off to go back to being a human hand. And as he's stepping on the grating, it's kind of like his feet are just melding with it and just still taking on the appearance of the grate. So he's kind of, you know, it shows that he's glitching and he's been affected, he's been hurt. But the coolest part is that, like, and you lose this in the theatrical cut, is that that's the way that John Connor ultimately tells the two Sarahs apart, is that the T-1000 still has half of its foot as a metal grate when he looks down, because it's glitching at that point. So that's how he knows that that's not Sarah. And that's so much, I mean, I know it's kind of cool. It's like, oh, he just knows it's a second instinct. But that's such a cool scene when you actually see it like that. And he's like, all right. Yeah, so cool. But the last thing I want to mention, well, a couple of things. First of all, the kind of what must, I'm guessing, be an homage to The Thing when they use the grenade and blow up the T-1000. And it's just this weird, you know, head attached to loose bits of just things screaming and like, it looks so cool, but so horrifying. And just, again, the genius idea of, like, when it dies, they were struggling to think of, like, what to do to really show the effect. And whoever had the idea that it would just cycle through everybody it had imitated in the course of the movie before ultimately dying, like, as a scream effect. It's like, oh, it's so good. I love it. Yeah, so that's enough from me about the VFX and such like that. Anything else from you?
No, that's everything, dude.
So, do you have anything on the music and the sound?
I do. Obviously, Brad Fidel's score, fantastic.
That main theme is just untouchable.
Oh God, yeah. And for something that is supposed to replicate something so cold and emotionless, it always gets me welling up. I don't know about you, but I always it strikes a chord with me, that main theme. But, yeah, one of the main percussive sounds of Fidel's score, the metallic beats of the Terminator theme, not created by a synthesizer, not taken from archives of recorded sound. It is Fidel just smashing one of his cast iron frying pans around.
So what I'm going to do, that I did kind of promise that I would talk about the changes to the different version, the special edition version. So I'm going to go over that before we hit the audience response, if I could. I'll try and get through it as quick as I can. So the biggest change for me, and again, the thing that I really don't love that we lost, after John Connor robs the ATM and heads for the mall, Sarah has a drug-induced dream in the hospital where Kyle Reese appears. It's the only time Michael Biehn appears in the film is on the special edition, and Kyle warns her that she needs to save their son from danger, and they kiss and hug, but Reese disappears and walks out. Sarah chases him outside, only to find herself in the same spot as the nuclear nightmare later in the movie. She sees the large white flash and then wakes up. And I love that scene. I think it's one of the things that I miss the most in the non-special edition, but it was cut because Cameron thought the audience might be confused by the appearance of Kyle Reese and not know who he was, which is silly. But
okay. I was astounded to find out that Reese was in this. And
yeah, well, only in that version. Yeah. This is the other one that I really lament missing in the other version, is there's an extended scene at the abandoned gas station when the Terminator talks about how its CPU is a learning computer. And he adds that it was switched to read-only because before being sent out, Skynet didn't want their units thinking too much on their own. John asks if it can be reset, and you then see the Terminator's face in a mirror that we've mentioned, talking Sarah through the operation. After the CPU is removed, the Terminator shuts down and Sarah places it on a table. She picks up a hammer and tries to smash it to render it inoperative. John stops her and says they need him. He starts to show authority for the first time and asks how he's supposed to be a great military leader if even his own mother won't listen to him. And so she reluctantly reinserts the chip back in the Terminator's head, which is now set as to learn, basically. Again, I think we really need all that. I think that's great. A scene at a truck shop, a truck stop is missing before John, Sarah, and Terminator arrive at the Salcedo farm. John points out to Terminator he shouldn't be so serious all the time. He encourages him to smile once in a while. The Terminator tries, but the result is less than convincing and humorous. So John tells him to practice in front of a mirror. Not a huge loss there. So it's our time then to cross over to you, the audience, and see what you think of Terminator 2, if that's not a slightly redundant question. And so, because I've been talking a lot with the special edition, you know, read through there, I'm going to throw it over to you, DK, to start us off, and you have the first half of what the audience have got to say about T2.
Yeah, I'm going to start off with the Northeast Retro Den. And the first one is from David Howland. He says, "At the time, I remember going to see a film and the music faded up in darkness, then the slam of the steel shutters and coming down. It's all it needed. The film didn't let us down. From the reveal that Arnie was good now and Robert was like a souped-up super cop, John Connor was a bit whiny, but when he woke up to his mom possibly trying to be a hero, not just a crackpot, you just needed to strap in as they each tried to fix the future and second-guess each other's moves." James Hoodhead, he says, "It's an easy 6 out of 5 for me. Cinematic masterpiece. The extended cuts adds quite a bit as well. The way they used twins in a few scenes was brilliant, not to mention the dedication of Robert Patrick to learn how to run without breathing hard and making sure he never blinked. The small details make this so good." Ross Manning says, "It really is the perfect sequel. Even if you take away the revolutionary CGI and practical effects, its story takes everything from T1 and ramps it up." Oh, everybody's agreeing with us here, dude. "You've got this huge expansion on the lore and world building hinted at in the first movie. There is complete role reversal with the T-800 and T-1000, as well as this incredible character arc for Sarah Connor, who's gone from your every woman to a survivor. There isn't a single poor performance from any actor, and Ed Furlong as John Connor was a revelation. It's a clear 5 out of 5 for him." Edward Edmonds says it's in his top 10 films of all time. Ross Hannon says it was a game changer in Hollywood action blockbusters, but also started killing off gritty, lower budget, intelligent sci-fi, like the first Terminator, which in my opinion was the better film. And then that's it from that group. Going on to the Cult Cinema and TV group, and we've got a, I'm guessing this is a contender for the Hot Take Award this time. Al Winter, he gives it 2 stars, and then he says, "Chase movie for me." Not sure exactly what that means, but yeah, he's not a fan from the sound of it. And Daniel Facer gives it 5 stars. He says it was one of the best science fiction films of all time, and that's the feedback I have.
Awesome. Well, I'll just finish us off then. So from the Silver Screen Facebook group, my friend Dave Eglon says, "I'd say it's up there with one of the best action films ever made." From the group Cinema of the 90s and Beyond, Joe Postow says, "Best sequel on par with The Godfather Part 2. From the group Action and Sci-Fi, Kurt Marvel, great name, says, "The worst Terminator was Geniuses. This one was awesome." Oh, the worst Terminator was Genesis. This one was awesome, I guess is what it means. Sorry about that. Chris R. says 15 out of 5 stars, and yet the first one is somehow better. On our Discord in the movies channel, Jamie J.A. Productions says, "I mean, what do you want me to say? It's Terminator 2. I think it speaks for itself." In the Nerdy Up North Facebook group, Gary Kirkpatrick says, "In my older years now, I've grown to actually see 1 and 2 on equal footing. To me, 1 is more thriller slash horror, which I love, and 2 is balls out blockbuster action. I would say for me, not many films deserve to be put on the pedestal of as close to movie perfection as you can get, but T2 is certainly up there." From the same place, Craig Stedman says, "Greatest sequel of all time." Andy Bulmer simply says 5. Carl Moore says, "I saw this when it was first out in the 90s. The first Arnie film I saw growing up, and I've been a huge fan ever since. Also, the 3D re-release for cinemas was brilliantly well-timed. 29th of August 2017, the 20th anniversary of Skynet's nuclear attack." Wow, didn't know that. Okay. Stephen O'Neill just says classic. Xavier LaRouge says 6 stars. Michael Whelan says 5 stars, as good as the original, possibly the 2 greatest sci-fi action films ever made, both 1 and 2, and in my opinion, way ahead of its time. The special effects still stand up to today's effects, are true masterpieces, only to be sullied by every other attempt after it. Well, maybe not Salvation. Almost agreeing with us there. Gaz Wilson says, "One of only a handful of sequels that far surpasses the original." From the group Action and Sci-Fi Movies of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, Christian Michael says, "I would say it's a perfect film, but part one exists." From Nerdy Up North again, Cheney Rabbit, again, great name, says, "I showed my mate T1 and 2, who had never seen them before. We both preferred the first one, and the second wasn't as good as I remembered growing up. Oof. If you swapped out all the songs for just music, it would be fine, but Guns N' Roses, Bad to the Bone, really changed the tone compared to the first, and some of the humor ruined it for us. 4 stars. Oof. From All Things Sci-Fi Fantasy Horror Group, Christopher Armstrong says, "I hope you're talking about the Skynet edition with bonus scenes." Yes, we've mentioned it as promised. And from Nerdy Up North, Distant Screams, Props, Sets and Events says, this was and probably still is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I personally think it's aged really well considering the leaps in CGI since then. And just finally, because I always mention this on our classics shows whenever it comes up, I should note that in 2023, so just last year, the Library of Congress selected Terminator 2 Judgment Day for preservation in the National Film Registry as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, and not before time, in my opinion. So, yeah, that's a lot of mostly positive, I would say, thoughts on Terminator 2. So, yeah. So you've heard from the audience. Now we have to give our opinions on various things, starting with our favourite character moment and line. So there's only you and I here, DK, so we haven't got to rely on guests not giving us an answer. So first of all, who's your favourite character in this and why?
It's got to be the Schwarzenegger Terminator. And it's for everything that we've mentioned before. Schwarzenegger gives an incredibly understated performance. And he is the most human out of everybody pretty much in this movie.
Yeah, fantastic. I don't disagree with you, but I went with Sarah because I just said the sheer change between movies and the fact that she is rightfully an iconic and now legendary female badass. I think, yeah, incredible. My favourite character in the movie, I have to give it to her. So what is your favourite moment or scene?
I think mine's going to be the entire escape from the mental institution.
That's cool.
Yeah, I think that it's incredibly tense where they end up in the car and he's after them.
That is a great scene. I also picked a whole scene, but for me, it's the viaduct chase that I've mentioned. So everything from the first moment that, you know, John on his dirt bike, the Terminator on a motorbike and the T-1000 in a truck start to the very end where the T-1000 just walks through fire unharmed. That entire sequence for me is just, chef's kiss, brilliant. So, yeah, love it. And what's your favourite line in the movie? There's several to choose from.
Yeah, it's got a few iconic ones, but I'm going to go with what I said earlier. The unknown future rolls towards us. I face it for the first time with a sense of hope. Because if a machine, a Terminator, can learn the value of human life, maybe we can too.
That is literally what I have written down.
Yay!
That's the first time we've ever had the same favourite line.
I think it is.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Okay. There was Ready Player One with the Chucky.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. So, yeah, I can't disagree. It's my favourite as well. So then all that remains then is for us to give our conclusion and our score out of 5 stars. And Geeky, I'm going to throw it over to you to start, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, no worries. As we've mentioned, I gave James Cameron a lot of flack on this show. Any regular listener will know I'm not necessarily his biggest fan. But this one, it's seldom that a sequel outpaces the original. But as much of a fan as I am of 1984's The Terminator, this one just blows me away. To paraphrase another iconic movie, it takes all the elements of its predecessor and turns it up to 11. Schwarzenegger and Hamilton give great performances that breathe new life into their respective characters. Furlong gives a good turn as the young John Connor, and Patrick will forever be known as the T-1000. So successful was he in inhabiting that role. The story only serves to embellish what came before, filling out the corners of the map to a point where the original and this one are literally two parts of the same story. Forget anything that came afterwards, this is the definitive ending. And then there's the direction and production values. There are some truly horrific scenes in this, which they still keep me up at night. And there are also some heart-pounding action sequences. But those special effects are still, to this day, unmatched. Yes, a shot or two occasionally show their age, but for the most part, this still looks fantastic. And together with its stylized cinematography, this looks just as crisp watching it today as it did on the day of release. And that's why, Cameron or not, I will be giving this one 5 stars.
Oh, wow. Okay. right. That was a long one. But yeah, I think all valid. I said, okay, full disclosure, and I'll come out and say it now in case it hasn't been obvious for this entire review. This is my favourite film of all time. In my opinion, it's a perfect movie. The plot, the action, the little touches, the themes, the integration of big sci-fi ideas, the groundbreaking effects, okay, my preferred version is the special edition, but only because it gives me even more of a good thing, and frankly, I can't get enough. There's a reason this film is cited as hugely influential to multiple films and filmmakers that followed. It cemented James Cameron as a legend, and Avatar 2, notwithstanding, one of my favorite writer-directors. Even after four attempts at a sequel, they never came close to this. Maybe they were fools for even trying. As a side note, the only sequel worth bothering with is the TV series The Sarah Connor Chronicles. But in summary, this is the best sequel ever made, untouchable brilliance, one of the reasons I love movies, something special, my beloved. Do we have enough superlatives yet? And I obviously gave it 5 out of 5 and then just wrote the word duh. So, yeah, not really difficult to work out the average since there's just two of us. So with 2 5 out of 5s, we are again in a situation where we have to say Terminator 2 has a perfect score. Woo! 5 out of 5, perfect movie. Thoroughly deserved, I think, as well. So, yeah. I do happen to know that if Will Dick had joined us, that he also would have given it a 5 out of 5 because he has already on Letterboxd. So it's not just because there's only two of us that it got a perfect score, but certainly it's nice that it did. So yeah, I think it's such a good movie. If you haven't watched it in a while, just stick it on, give it a watch.
Yeah, I can second that. I've not seen it in quite some time until today, and oh yes.
Yeah, very good film. So yeah, as our somewhat known future rolls towards us with various things that are planned, stay tuned to this year's Silver Screen podcast. We have various things coming up. You can find us in all the usual places, which will be on screen if you're watching on YouTube. I'll edit the little graphic in, but you can always find it in our description, a link to our Linktree, which has all of the various social medias there. You can you can see that in your podcatcher of choice or in the YouTube descriptions, and just follow that to find us. You're always welcome to join any of our groups and things. Our Facebook group is picking up a bit at the moment. I'm currently doing a tournament for the best film of the 1980s, which seems to be gathering pace. So if you're on Facebook and you want to join.
Jump in on that, because frankly, the audience feedback we had from our Facebook group on this one was appalling.
What, on Terminator 2? Or...
Yeah, just one from our group. Oh, man.
I know, yeah, I know. But I think it's because it is one of those films that kind of speaks for itself, but yeah. So yeah, do join us there if you can, and we're all over the rest of the internet, usually as just Silver Screen Podcast or my name, Michael Wilson. But yeah, stay tuned, though. We are going to be coming back with more on this channel and eventually on our Hit or Miss Star Trek. We're going to pick that back up again very soon. Yeah, and that's about it. You can find me on the internet, usually wherever you find the podcast. And DK, I'm guessing they can find you in a hole somewhere.
Yeah, no Terminator's tracking me down.
DK is living off the grid, ironically, just like John Connor in Terminator 3, a movie he loves.
God.
So yeah, thanks so much for listening if you've listened to this all the way through, and hopefully you'll enjoy the others we're talking about, because it makes it more interesting to hear us yammer on about it. So yeah, come back later, and in the meantime, just remember, in the epic words of Arnie, hasta la vista, baby.
Hasta la vista, baby.
You've been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Cut!